Well, welcome everyone to the teleclass Out of Africa. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to say that we are delighted to have you join us on this teleclass today. If you join teleclasses regularly, you will have heard me mention before our initiatives for infection control education in developing countries. One of the people who introduced me to the need for infection control education in developing nations is my friend Dr. Adriano Duse. If you do a web search using his name, you will find out that he is involved in just way too many things to mention here. He is a very popular speaker at conferences and has had a really tremendous impact on infection control in Africa. He's one of those people who is so well educated that the letters after his name take up more room than the name itself, and in Adriano's case, require an entire line of their own. He's a smart guy and a fun guy to hang around, and I'm really pleased that he's able to make this time for us. So from the Department of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases of the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, to present the teleclass Out of Africa, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Adriano Duse. Adriano.
Well, greetings everybody from a very cold and wintry South Africa. It is a huge privilege to present this teleclass to you, and of course I have to thank Paul Weber for giving me this opportunity. The title of my first slide, Out of Africa, really indicates the interesting dilemmas that we face in a country that is really a land of contrast, a land of contrast in many respects, in that we have in fact hospitals which could be really equated to first-class facilities anywhere in the world, as well as in fact rural areas which are grossly underprovided. Now, the Latin quote that you see on that first slide, Ex Africa semper aliquid nova, was attributed to Pliny the Elder. And in effect, this means that from Africa, there is always something new. And in fact, within the context of the challenges in infectious diseases and infection control, this quote could not be more appropriate. If you turn to the next slide, the objectives of this presentation are to give you a smattering of background information to South African hospitals, describe to you that we as a continent have really identified and generated many organisms, and these are the organisms that I refer to as the out-of-Africa bugs. I'm going to briefly review multidrug resistance within the context of South Africa and indicate to you the nosocomial, transnational, and transcontinental spread of some of the clones that we have here. Very importantly for limited countries with resources that are not readily available, we often have to redefine the gold standard, and it is therefore important for us to be fairly flexible and imaginative on how we do it. I also then want to share some of the good things about infection control issues in South Africa, some of the bad things, and the positively ugly. And finally conclude by giving you some suggestions for the way ahead for South Africa and conclude on that presentation. Just to really set the flavor for this talk, I want to take you in fact to Johannesburg 1996, where on the next slide you'll see that a 46-year-old anesthetic assistant who worked in a private clinic in Johannesburg became ill with fever on the 2nd of November 1996. Some 3 days later she presented with an extremely excruciating headache, so much so that she was taking a shower and she was crying from the pain. She was a very stoic woman and her husband was rather surprised, and when he asked her what the problem was, she said that she had never experienced a pain more excruciating than that was present at the time. On the 6th to the 13th, there were a number of events that happened to this individual. She was diagnosed as possibly having encephalitis and she was admitted. But on taking blood tests, she was found to be leukopenic, she had thrombocytopenia, and deranged liver function test. And over time, her renal functions deteriorated to the point that she required dialysis on the 13th of November. On the 14th of November, the presumptive laboratory diagnosis of Ebola virus was definitively confirmed. one day later. And from the 16th to the 22nd, there were a number of events that involved the patient being transferred to the hospital to which I'm affiliated, the Johannesburg Hospital. She was in a critical condition, hemorrhaging, and she was transferred from the private clinic with secondary nosocomial bacterial and fungal infections, a Staph aureus and a Candida albicans. She developed a large intracranial hemorrhage on the 22nd of November and unfortunately demised on the 24th of that same month. The next slide shows you what the primary case or source was all about. It was quite interesting to notice that whilst the Department of Health had the confirmation of the diagnosis of Ebola, it took over the logistical aspects and formed immediately committees to manage contact tracing, infection control, media liaison, and of course medical examination of sick contacts and others suspected of having hemorrhagic fevers. In the interim, of course, whilst in fact this patient had already actually been admitted into the hospital, a number of important things occurred. Firstly, the doctor was transported by air from Libreville in Gabon and admitted to a private clinic on the 27th of October, where our index case was exposed to the patient. On the 29th, the anesthetic assistant particularly was found to be exposed to large amounts of his blood whilst inserting a central venous catheter and the subsequent cleaning up process. Now, quite interestingly, this very sick primary case or the source of infection really did not present with anything that was typically hemorrhagic. In fact, he had an unusual clinical presentation and was misdiagnosed as suffering from a polymyositis overlap syndrome. He was given hydrocortisone, which resulted in almost a prompt improvement, upon which he was discharged on the 11th of November 1996. On the 16th, he was traced back by the Department of Health to a convalescence home, and Ebola titers greater than 1 in 512 were confirmed, and this indicated that he was a primary case. Now, this whole sequence of events really forced us to really carefully look at nosocomial implications of viral hemorrhagic fevers for South Africa. First, it's pertinent to note that in this outbreak, there were more than 300 contacts, which were traced and observed. Some of these were involved in procedures such as central line placement, gastroscopy, colonoscopy, marrow biopsies. In other words, they were exposed to large amounts of patient fluids and blood. What is very interesting is that no one else contracted the disease, although it took, in fact, quite some time for the diagnosis to be made. And it made us think that perhaps it's possible that the infectivity of Ebola virus is not as great as initially presumed, and that simple basic standard and contact precautions, based on our current understanding of the transmission of strains infectious to humans of this virus, may well be adequate. And this simply means that basic infection control measures go a very long way in preventing infections by novel pathogens that are shown to spread primarily by the contact route. If you move to the next slide, there are a couple of things that I would like to point out to you. Firstly, the individual on the top left-hand corner, Margarita Isaacson. Margarita Isaacson was in fact a professor of tropical diseases in our department who passed away in 2001. She was probably one of the most important international experts in the fields of cholera and plague in southern Africa and the viral hemorrhagic fevers. And the story goes that Margarita, who was in fact a fairly tempestuous and very, very strong-willed person, was so intimidating that when she did go to Central Africa to deal with virus diseases, such as those caused by Ebola and Marburg, the viruses were so terrified of her that they thought twice about infecting her. So in a sense, her character gave her a very peculiar type of immunity. She was also in fact an extremely practical woman, and she saw that in blood-stained wards in Central Africa, the most important thing was to actually roll up one's sleeves with a basic amount of protective equipment that was sensible at the time and available, and start cleaning up and segregating patients who were infected in appropriate isolation cubicles. Now, as you scan across this slide, you can see that from this somewhat practical approach of Margarita Isaacson, when we encountered Ebola in 1996, we immediately went for high-level precaution. So our laboratory staff and our nursing personnel were asked to don, in fact, Rakal respirators. And paradoxically, these systems were extremely hindering to patient care. It's also important to remember that the more sophisticated the donning of clothes is, the more you have to train your personnel to function safely and effectively. It is not cheap, this type of apparel, and more importantly, it's usually not available to the primary and secondary healthcare workers, who are normally the first people to have contact with a suspected VHF case. We also found that the Department of Health made some bizarre requests. For instance, they asked us that all the waste from analyzers at Johannesburg Hospital should be discharged into containers half filled with sodium hypochlorite before disposal into the main drains. Now, bear in mind that it took, in fact, a good 10 days for the diagnosis of Ebola to be made. And during this period, the patient's blood went into normal laboratories, went through thousands of analyzers on an almost daily basis, and went down the South African sewers, as is the practice for discard of effluent. So the stringent procedure of requesting, particularly when the patient had antibodies and was probably somewhat less viremic than in the acute stages of the illness, requesting that such fluids be collected really paradoxically increased the risk of exposure of healthcare personnel. So re-looking at what goes on in Central Africa and the basic infection control measures that are usually instituted to curb problems like Ebola, and you can see this type of scenario in the bottom left-hand slide, we felt that in fact we should nurse our patients in apparel that is comfortable and is convenient and safe. And so we've redefined our dress code as simple goggles, a good quality mask, a water repellent gown, double gloving, and overshoes to protect from the severe blood hemorrhages that occur in these patients. And we have found this to be a reasonably good working model for the management of the VHF patients that we see in our country. Now, that we have sort of whetted the appetite and discussed very briefly some of the types of scenarios that frequently occur, and sometimes at the most unexpected times, the most unexpected clinic. Let me give you a little bit of background about the South African public health system so that you get to know my country a little bit better. If you turn to the slide with South African Public Health System 2001, you'll see that as of 2001, the South African population was in the region of 45 million people. Because of historical inequalities and because of poverty, the vast majority of the population, some 38 million people, are dependent on public sector healthcare. And you can see how many beds are available at each of the different levels of institutions expressed as beds per 1,000 of the population. And it's interesting to note that in general, in South Africa, overall, for a country that is upper middle income categorized by the World Bank, we have about 2.65 beds as compared to a norm that was described in an article by Barnum and Kutzen in 1993 of 6. So we do not have, in fact, hugely available bed resources, and our population frequently lands up in facilities that are overcrowded. Next slide, please. If you look at our admission rate per 1,000 of the population, this is increasing quite dramatically, and the HIV pandemic is in fact also an extremely important motive force for this. You'll see that we are looking at approximately 83.7 admissions per 1,000 population. Move to the next slide and let me show you a couple of South African hospitals so that you familiarize yourself with the types of volumes that we deal with. Groote Schuur Hospital, as of May 2002, was a hospital in the Cape that really admitted up to 40,000 patients a year. On an outpatient clinic basis, almost 500,000 patients are seen yearly. The hospital is very well renowned. You may recall that the famous heart surgeon, Chris Barnard, performed the first transplant in this hospital. The percentage-based occupancy at Groote Schuur is in the region of about 74.6%, and it's reasonably well-staffed with a fair amount of well-trained and highly sophisticated medical and nursing staff. Now, please cast your eye onto the total annual expenditure of approximately 662 million South African rand. The rand-dollar exchange, very crudely, is about 6 rand to a dollar. If you have a look at the resources of Groote Schuur Hospital, historically, in fact, a bastion of white hospital care delivery, and you just flick on to the next slide, we'd like to show you Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, you'll see that this hospital receives, for seeing many more patients, and admitting many more on a yearly basis. Marginally more money, instead of about 600 million rand, it gives 767 million rand. Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital was historic, in fact, a black hospital. It spans over 173 acres and even made it in the Guinness Book of Records in 1997 as being the largest healthcare facility in the world. Note that in contrast to the previous slide, Groote Schuur Hospital admitting only 40,000 patients per year, the admissions at Chris Hani Baragwanath are in the region of 178,000. The outpatient department also looks at roughly 500,000 people, and the total number of beds of this hospital in terms of its maximum capacity is 3,400 beds, with currently 2,600 open to the public. The bed occupancy is often horrific, so frequently we find that bed occupancy is up to 350%, clearly making it very difficult with this excessive overcrowding and this limited budgeted expenditure to carry out appropriate infection control processes. So really what I want you to see from these two slides is that there are some interesting vestiges from, in fact, the previous era, the pre-1994 period, where typically white hospitals were extremely well provisioned and very sophisticated, and much larger hospitals with great patient loads, like Chris Hani Baragwanath, have been historically and remain under huge amounts of financial stress. When this is going to be addressed from an equity point of view is not 100% clear, but clearly this is one of the directions that the Department of Health is aiming towards. Next slide, please. Having given you a very brief background of how contrasting the available facilities are, I would like to describe to you some organisms that I would like to say are out of Africa. This means that they were either typically discovered in Africa and from Africa, they may have actually been responsible for nosocomial outbreaks by moving transnationally between borders or moving even transcontinentally and spreading globally. And of these organisms, next slide please, I'd like to divide these into the viruses, Lassa fever, Marburg and Ebola viruses, a very unique strain of measles virus that is a South African strain that we successfully exported to the United States, HIV 1 and 2 that is deemed to have originated from Africa, and a wide variety of other viruses such as West Nile fever virus, Rift Valley fever virus, chikungunya and Wesselbron viruses, all of which have actually been exported through either movement of people or animals or vectors. And then you all know how sensitive the issue is that the Africans have again exported monkeypox to the United States and have given you yet another infectious disease to contend with. Of the bacteria, I would like to discuss some organisms that are of particular interest to me, and these are South African pneumococcal strains that are uniquely bred and ours, a salmonella called Salmonella Johannesburg, coming from the region where I live and work, Salmonella Isangi, Shigella dysenteria type 1, and briefly also touch on African tick bite fevers, rickettsial infections that we have exported successfully. And then also talk to you about South African strains of Mycobacterium tuberculosis and how these easily spread in and out of healthcare facilities and into the community. From a parasitic point of view, although by no means is malaria uniquely African phenomenon, I've decided to incorporate that because a lot of the travelers that we have coming to visit our continent may acquire malaria whilst they're here, and then go back to the country of origin with an infection that is tropical and sometimes difficult to detect. Also note that we have successfully exported African trypanosomiasis through a wide variety of means, and possibly the most important is, in fact, infected blood. Let's move to the next slide, and let's touch on the organisms first discovered in Africa that are of nosocomial importance. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to touch on Lassa fever, on Marburg and Ebola viruses, and HIV 1 and 2. I'm not going to say terribly much at all on monkeypox virus, but if you're interested, we can actually discuss it in greater detail when we get to the end of the lecture. Now, Lassa fever is the first organism that I want you to look at on the following slide. It belongs to the family Rhinoviridae, and the virus is an enveloped RNA virus. It was first described in West Africa in the 1950s, but it was not isolated from a patient until 1969. This virus occurs from Nigeria to Guinea, resulting in about 5,000 deaths annually. In 2000, 5 cases brought in from Sierra Leone were exported to Europe. As you know, the transmission is predominantly rodent to human, but in fact person-to-person transmission has also been documented. But most importantly, all of these horrific viruses that induce so much fear are very frequently, in fact, propagated and amplified through bad nosocomial infection practices, or bad infection control practices, I beg your pardon. We know that the prominent mode of transmission in healthcare facilities of hemorrhagic fever viruses include things like use of contaminated injections and needles in West Africa, staff exposures due to inadequate barrier nursing, Sharps injuries, ill-advised surgery and colonoscopies on infected patients, thus leading to great exposures to blood. And we also know that these formidable agents can be very effectively terminated by simply paying attention to the basic principles of infection control, basic isolation procedures, standard precautions and contact precautions, appropriate protective clothing, the donning of gloves and gowns, making sure that you dispose of needles adequately, making sure that you don't actually use unsterilized single-use equipment for multiple patients, and basically adhering to simple, basic, common-sense infection control. On the next slide, you'll see the next virus called the Marburg virus. This is, in fact, a filovirus and is extremely similar in many respects to Ebola virus. You'll notice that Marburg virus was first identified in 1967, and it was reported from Marburg in Germany, where in both Germany and Yugoslavia, a number of people were exposed to important African green monkeys. Notice the African link. And these monkeys had been captured in Uganda, and they came down, in fact, with an illness. In South Africa, we saw Marburg for the first time on the coastline of our country in a town, ironically, also called Marburg, where two tourists that were tracking across Africa and eventually entered Zimbabwe and crossed the South African border, reaching the South African coastline and the town of Marburg, became extremely sick. And it was discovered, and this is where Margarita Isaacson made one of her biggest impacts, that they were suffering from Marburg virus disease. There have, of course, been subsequent outbreaks of Marburg in Africa, in Zimbabwe in 1975 and 1982, and in Kenya in 1980 to 1987. Please note that, in fact, some of these viruses are important to understand from a biological perspective, because it may not have entered your mind that viruses may survive, for instance, in semen of a convalescent patient, particularly viruses such as Marburg, Lassa fever, and indeed Ebola, for up to 83 to 90 days after the disease onset. This has an implication on the type of advice that you give to the convalescent patient. One of the important things is that they either abstain from intercourse or, if they really insist, try and aim for protected sex using condoms or appropriate barriers. We also know that the virus may persist in convalescent states in the anterior chamber of the eye, and this has been documented quite carefully. Notice that prevention and treatment of the horrific Marburg virus is again based on simple infection control practice. And this hopefully will become a recurring theme as we go through all of these viruses, that basic infection control and simple common sense measures go a long way to prevent further hospital amplification and cross-infection. The next slide will actually give you some indication and some interesting points about Ebola virus, a very closely related virus to Marburg. Also filovirus, it was discovered in 1976, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly known as Zaire, where 318 cases were described. In Kikwit, there was a second outbreak with this virus, which really actually commands an extremely high mortality, where quite easily up to 70 to 80% of patients that are infected with the strain die. In Kikwit, there were 316 cases, and interestingly noticed that 25% of these were healthcare workers. Again, nosocomial amplification of infection. In Gabon, quite interestingly, there was an Ebola DRC strain outbreak in 1994-1995, and even in 1996, a time that coincides with the arrival of the Gabonese doctor to South Africa, when he was extremely ill and became the source patient that led to the death of our nursing sister. in Gabon and the Democratic Republic of Congo, again, Ebola DRC strain reared its ugly head, and an outbreak was actually documented in 2001 and 2. Ebola Sudan is somewhat less virulent than Ebola DRC or Ebola Zaire as a strain, and its mortality is deemed to be a mere 50%. So only 1 in 2 patients die, as opposed to almost uniformly the vast majority. The Ebola Sudan outbreaks have been documented in Sudan in 76 and 79, and in Uganda over 2000-2001. There's an interesting entity which I'm sure most of the listeners from the United States are well aware of, and that is Ebola resistant strain, which is a strain that is infective to humans but does not lead to human clinical disease. Whilst in monkeys and primates, this particular strain is extremely virulent and leads to their death. Ebola restant probably has been the one strain that has been most strongly postulated to be borne by the airborne route or spread by the airborne route. And in terms of the epidemiology surrounding, in fact, hemorrhagic fevers caused by Ebola virus, we would be surprised if, in fact, the other strains of Ebola, such as Ebola DRC, Ebola Sudan, and Ebola Cote d'Ivoire, were airborne spread. The epidemiology of infection doesn't really suggest that this is a persuasive argument. Notice that, again, Ebola can also be isolated from semen of convalescents. We can sometimes find abundant viral antigen particles in the skin of these patients, and sometimes we possibly pose that they may play an etiological role for contact transmission. But, of course, it's all this contact with blood and high-risk body fluids that are the predominant mode of spread. The virus, all the Ebola viruses, through experimental means have been shown to be potentially spread by the airborne route. But as I've mentioned, the evidence of airborne spread of Ebola is less persuasive. And then, of course, very importantly, and a universal feature of all the hemorrhagic fevers, is that they're readily spread through percutaneous exposures, by laboratory accidents, by direct physical contact with blood, stool, or vomitus of the patient. And you'll notice on my prevention and treatment side of the slide that handling of the dead is one of the ways in which the virus may be spread. There are certain customs in Africa, in certain groups of people, where it is considered to be respectful to manually evacuate the bowel contents of the recently deceased before burial. And clearly this leads to huge potential exposures with the blood in the GIT or gastrointestinal tract of such patients. Please notice that these viruses are not cysts. Although, in fact, these viruses are intracellular parasites, viral survival has actually been shown for Ebola in syringes in excess of 7 days, indeed up to 14 days, at those awful tropical ambient temperatures of 35 degrees. So do not assume that because the virus is out of the body and it's exposed to rather unfriendly and hot conditions, its survival is low. These things can persist for long periods of time. The next slide, again, will show you some of the important scenes of the Kikwit outbreak in 1995. Firstly, on the top left-hand corner is the filoviral structure of Ebola. You can see a highly pleomorphic virus that really looks, in fact, like strands, I like to think, being largely Italian, of spaghetti. When you move across the slide, you can see that funeral practices are still possible, and again, when people operate in Central Africa, the type of gear that is donned, even accompanying the body to burial, is basically very simple. In this case, safety helmet, of course, goggles and protective eyewear, although it's unlikely that the corpse is going to splurt out blood from its canopy. Generally speaking, as a precaution, double gloving and appropriate protective gowns. And there you can see some other scenes from the Kikwit outbreak to show you the devastation that these diseases cause when they occur. The next virus that we claim, in fact, some ownership is a Congo-Crimean hemorrhagic fever virus. Although it was discovered in the 1930s, we like to think that it is an African pathogen. It was, in fact, discovered in Stanleyville in the Belgian Congo in 1968, and this was the time when the virus was isolated. Today, infections are widespread over Eastern Europe, Asia, Middle East, China, and indeed all of Africa. In South Africa, we had the first case diagnosed in 1981, and virtually now the disease is endemic, and we see cases on a year-to-year basis. In Tigerberg, it's important that in 1996 there was an outbreak, And most specifically, in the Cape region of the South Karoo, 16 ostrich abattoir workers, working in fact with dead birds, were thought to have acquired the disease from ostriches. Right, in terms of the properties of the virus is more labile, and all of the forensic pathologists tell us that it's unlikely to live post-mortem more than 3 days. But one occasion, we actually caught them out, and we asked them to send tissue samples from cadaveric material of a post-mortem performed 9 days after the death of the patient, and this yielded, in fact, extremely viable growth of Congo Crimean hemorrhagic fever. Although the disease is, of course, transmitted largely by ticks, it's a zoonotic infection. Nosocomial transmission has been very well documented when surgeons, nursing staff, and other healthcare workers either come into direct contact with blood or sustain sharp injuries or fail to observe barrier techniques. Airborne infection is not deemed to be a problem, unless, of course, the virus is aerosolized during autopsy. Again, infection control is very simple, and notice that, in fact, post-exposure prophylaxis with drugs like ribavirin have been postulated to have a positive outcome on patients that have been at risk. So if you move to the next slide, notice how simple VHF isolation precautions are. Isolate the patient. Use simple but effective personal protective equipment. Reinforce among staff standard and contact precautions. Make sure that the protocols for the safe disinfection of spools, remembering that all of these viruses are eminently susceptible to fairly low-grade disinfectants. Remember to dispose of sharps and contaminated waste. Remember that if you're in a scenario where you have to handle or bury corpses, this must be done safely. And above all, education is important to decrease the panic levels amongst patients and the community at large. So these simple rules really enable us to cope with any novel organism that comes our way. And in general, when it is a viral hemorrhagic fever, we feel quite comfortable that if we have low expectations of healthcare facilities to have basic protective equipment, these things can be managed fairly safely by all healthcare institutions. The minute you demand that people wear recall respirators or more complex equipment, there will be a differential in the level of protection and the level of skill. And as we saw in our previous slides, frequently these viral infections caused by the hemorrhagic viruses are undetected for many days before you actually click and you realize that you're dealing with a formidable pathogen. Now, the next slide will really actually indicate to you that HIV 1 and 2's origin is most probably African. There's a huge amount of evidence to suggest that HIV 1 has mutated from a simian immunodeficiency virus strain involving, in fact, chimpanzees of the Pan-Troglodytes group. HIV 2 almost certainly arose from a simian immunodeficiency virus strain affecting Sooty Mangabey monkeys. And both of these ape species are typically African. Please notice that again, many people ask us all the time, how long does HIV survive outside of the body? Well, it can survive in syringes for up to 4 weeks, although it's true that the viral titers drop dramatically after about 3 to 4 days. We've seen viable HIV up to 21 hours after the death of a patient. And this recommendation, although some people say that virions may actually survive for up to 7 days post-mortem, has led to postulated recommendations in South Africa that if we do an autopsy on an HIV patient, one should delay for 24 hours to markedly decrease viral infectivity. In post-mortem samples and a wide variety of other blood tubes, virus may actually survive for up to 14 days. So these are all interesting organisms that obviously are much more hardy environmentally than we all attribute them to be. Again, sharps and splash injuries are a problem, and within the context of developing countries, HIV may be spread as a consequence of reuse of single-use items, transfusion, plasmapheresis equipment, etc. How do we cope with it? Again, going back to basic infection control, and of course, finding needle tick injuries, post-exposure prophylaxis is important. We now move on to the third part of the talk, having briefly described South African healthcare facilities, having given you a taste of the viruses that we consider to be typically out of Africa, I'd like to talk to you about, in fact, multidrug-resistant organisms that are relevant within the context of nosocomial, transnational, and transcontinental spread on our continent. So let's start off with the first organism, which is Salmonella isangi. Salmonella isangi was first described in Sandyville in the Belgian Congo in 1947. And interestingly, in 1999, an extended spectrum beta lactamase producing strain appeared in our pediatric hospital, that large hospital that I showed you in the initial slide, which is grossly overcrowded, the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, the largest facility in the world. And this outbreak really persisted over a period of about 2 years. In 2002, round about December, from March to December of that year, in Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, there was yet another reemergence of 60 cases of ESBL-producing Salmonella isangi. Two healthcare workers were colonized, and the colonized healthcare workers, for a number of important reasons, were not treated of the colonization fate. Only, a couple of months after March, in May 2002, we started seeing the inter-hospital spread of this nosocomial strain of Salmonella isangi from Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital to a baby sanctuary for HIV orphaned infants, the Limbana Baby Sanctuary, where there was in fact a death from salmonellosis, and these were children that either had in fact a history of being admitted from Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital or from a nearby facility, Natalspruit. And what was important is that this documented very readily the inter-institutional spread of nosocomial salmonellosis with a multi-drug resistant strain. The interventions at all levels, including the Limbana Baby Sanctuary, involved very careful review of infection control procedures and implementation of policies that were simple for everybody to follow. We emphasized healthcare worker education, and regrettably, in my opinion, and this could be open to discussion, ciprofloxacin was administered to the carriers in these institutions. And the reason why ciprofloxacin was administered, in my opinion, injudiciously, is that the next step that occurred is that we started seeing ciprofloxacin-resistant strains of ESBL-producing organisms in those very same institutions, leaving very little left of the armamentarium of antibiotics. Next slide, please. Let's have a look at Salmonella Johannesburg, isolated in my city and identified by Kaufman and Henning in 1952. This is also an interesting salmonella because it seems to be strongly linked to nosocomial infection. In an annual report in 1966 of the South African Institute for Medical Research, it was described that there was an alarming increase in the incidence of S. Johannesburg in black patients in various hospitals. What was strange is that this was an unusual serotype. It hadn't been seen before, and it had a tendency to produce chronic infection. The strain was resistant to commonly used antibiotics, and apparently seemed to have high attack rates and infectivity. We exported the strains, ladies and gentlemen, to Hong Kong through exportation of foods and importation of our stuff in various parts of the world. And we know that South Africa also was responsible for importing a dog into Hong Kong who was under quarantine in 1974. Now, with the exportation of food to Hong Kong, where possibly Salmonella Johannesburg was transferred from one continent to another, it's interesting to notice that Salmonella Johannesburg was first detected in Hong Kong in 1971, where there were four cases. 1972, 783 cases were identified, and these became progressively higher numbers of cases in 73 and 74. Again, the organism that was typically, in fact, an organism with very peculiar and alarming tendencies to enjoy nosocomial spread caused a hospital outbreak in Hong Kong in 1974, when a pediatric general hospital, where there was overcrowding, heavy environmental contamination, and no apparent fecal carriage in healthcare workers, some 115 cases were described. And what is really quite important is the cross-infection rate that was deemed to be nosocomial was in the region of 24%. Today, Salmonella Johannesburg, I'm not proud to say, is amongst the 20 most common Salmonella cerevars amongst Canadian registered commercial egg-producing flocks. So a gift from South Africa to Canada is unfortunate exportation of this bug. With regards to the next slide, I want to talk to you about Shigella dysenteriae, an organism that really spread from Central Africa, in fact from Burundi, downwards to South Africa, from the 1970s to the 1990s, entering effectively our borders, causing epidemics of this multi-drug resistant strain in Mpumalanga province and KwaZulu-Natal. Of course, whatever is a problem from a community perspective, is bound to become a nosocomial issue. And it was not long when nosocomial transmission of multi drug resistant Shigella dysenteria type 1 was described in one chronic psychiatric hospital in Durban, South Africa, where 4 out of 10 patients died of MDR shigellosis, and it took only simple infection control measures again to halt the outbreak. Next slide, please. This may seem a little bit strange, but in terms of redefining the gold standard, this is not a bad example. This is a rubbish bin made of plastic, which has been overturned over a concrete slab. In some of the rural areas of Africa, and particularly in the South Karoo, an outbreak was described of Shigella dysenteria amongst municipal workers collecting feces from the homes of various residents. The feces was really collected by a bucket collection system and then disposed of by the municipal workers. What was really quite interesting is that within the community there was an outbreak of Shigella dysenteria, and municipal workers that were collecting these feces were succumbing to infection very, very readily. So we had to think of ingenious and simple ways, given the limited resources, of making sure that we could decontaminate, in fact, these buckets. And one of the things that we did is we selected black as a color. We allowed the sun to shine on these buckets, and we put them on concrete slabs. And the combination of the absorption of heat by the black bucket with the radiation of heat from the concrete and a thermometer placed in the very center of this showed us that we could actually reach temperatures of 75 degrees plus, clearly temperatures that were quite capable of destroying a wide variety of enteric pathogens, including shigellosis. This, combined with, again, education of municipal health workers removing fecal material, giving them basic protective clothing, resulted in termination of the outbreak amongst this population group. Next slide, please. The pneumococcus is an organism that has been of increasing interest worldwide, and South Africa, needless to say, can also compete in having its own unique pneumococcal clones that no doubt we have already exported to various parts of the world. The most successful global spread of a pneumococcus is the Spanish serotype 23F, which has really spread to many countries in the world, including to South Africa. In 1997, the Pneumococcal Epidemiology Network was established under the auspices of the International Union of Microbiological Societies. And within this epidemiology network, very largely driven and supported by South Africa, we identified 2 pneumococcal clones of serogroup 19A in South Africa. One, in fact, was a penicillin intermediate-resistant, uniquely South African clone, and one a multidrug-resistant clone. We also described a unique penicillin-resistant serotype 6B clone that has emerged locally in our country, and no doubt with time we will export it. Move to the next slide and you'll see, in fact, that the South African strain is represented in the gels that are presented there. So we are competing well in our exportation with the world by producing our own homebred strains and really comparing them to the produce of those of other countries. The next slide will show you that the pneumococcus too can be spread effectively nosocomially. And in fact, Kuhnhoff, in a study that was published in 1992, next slide please, showed that nosocomial acquisition of pneumococci in children was an important phenomenon. What he did is he screened patients on admission for pneumococcal carriage, and he found that 53% of patients, there were 100 children admitted in all, carried pneumococcal strains that included, in fact, multidrug-resistant strains in the nasopharyngeal swabs collected from these children. Because there was intervening hospitalization and sometimes antibiotic administration, the intervention that resulted in antibiotics being given to these children for other reasons, certainly not for colonization and carriage of pneumococci, resulted in a situation where in 28 of these children there was persistent carriage. What was interesting, however, in the study is that he documented that in addition to the persistent carriage, a further 17 children really acquired completely brand new serotypes of pneumococci that were clearly actually acquired as a consequence of cross-infection during hospitalization. We have now lots of evidence in our hospitals that HIV infection, and particularly the childhood serotypes, are spreading, in fact, quite effectively within the hospital environment, and this the pneumococcus is posing huge problems and challenges in the treatment and health of HIV-positive patients. The next slide will show you tuberculosis, where there's plenty of evidence to show that from communities, tuberculosis comes into the hospital setting. Within the hospital, there's nosocomial transmission, either patient to patient or patient to healthcare worker. And then on occasions, we sometimes hospitalize patients with multi-drug resistant TB and send them out in the community. They get looked after by family, and lo and behold, intrafamilial spread occurs as a consequence of that. These are problems that we deal with and that are really unfortunate. Nosocomial transmission on the next slide has been well documented, and I've given you references to read if you're interested in South African patient-to-patient or patient-to-healthcare worker transmission. So let's move to the next slide and describe, in fact, a hospital outbreak in the Sizwe Fever Hospital, where we house largely our MDR-TB patients that are hospitalized on long-term. In a particular ward, 7 HIV-positive patients were present. On initial hospital admission, 6 of those patients were infected with a drug-sensitive Mycobacterium tuberculosis strain. Over time, the 6 patients were exposed, in fact, the source case, a lady called Carol, and they acquired the multi-drug-resistant TB strain that she was infected with. These patients all presented with atypical clinical presentation, and following MDR-TB infection, all died within months. So the infection was rapidly fatal. Move to the next slide, please. Here you can see that Carol had been in the ward for a period of time from February to August. Each of the patients that came in with initially drug-sensitive tuberculosis were exposed in overlapping periods to Carol, and each of them acquired, in fact, the multi-drug resistant strain that Carol harbored. And if we move to the next slide, you can see that the green arrows effectively indicate to you the clonality of all the multi-drug resistant strains that were isolated from the patient. All the patient strains marked strain S were the outbreak strains, and you can see that these were markedly different from other MDR strains that were not, in fact, the outbreak strain dubbed strain S. These are the yellow arrows that you see on the bottom. So fingerprinting really confirmed to us that nosocomial infection had effectively occurred. How do we control nosocomial tuberculosis? Well, obviously it's important to identify patients as early as possible, and hence laboratory support and rapid diagnostic workup is essential. We usually have to promptly initiate airborne precautions, but they're much simpler than the ones that we see in CDC documents. We simply don't have negative pressure rooms. We're not able to actually implement things that are going to be undoable. And so, unfortunately, the initiation of airborne precautions is going to differ according to available resources and institution. Frequently, asking patients to cough into tissue by cough educating them is just about the only strategy that you can do to try and minimize the formation of droplet nuclei, which then obviously result in potential infection of other people. We're not saying that a tissue prevents the transmission of tuberculosis, no. This is clearly not the case. Not even surgical masks do so. But we're saying that we're mechanically breaking those mechanisms from the cough that result effectively in the potential for forming too many respiratory droplets that ultimately become droplet nuclei and mull around in the air waiting to be inhaled. Prompt initiation of anti-tuberculous drugs is extremely important, and monitoring of the adequacy of therapy is something that is part of our TB program. We frequently, however, have to really rely on simple things. For instance, use of sunshine and have our patients outside of the wards during the day because we don't have, in fact, multiple air changes that are always carefully controlled. It's always said that in Africa, if you have an open ward with lots of windows and it's big and spacious and lots of sunshine falls in, usually you will be able to achieve the equivalent of 6 air changes in the room. But this depends on airflow, on currents, on whether trees are around the ward, where it's situated, and so we can never really guarantee this or prove it very effectively. Right, next slide I'm not going to talk to you very much about, other than to tell you that African tick bite fever is something that you may acquire if you come and visit our country. A lot of people come to South African game reserves, and when they come to Southern Africa, they go back to the home countries having been bitten by a tick and presenting with tick bite fever. And our very own rickettsial strain was identified as being unique to other rickettsias, called Rickettsia africae, in 1992. by killing his colleagues in Zimbabwe to the north of our borders. Right, the next slide will show you again a tropical disease, malaria, which has got a number of interesting entities. Airport malaria, for instance, is a type of malaria that many people actually may acquire and is reported from time to time from European countries. This happens when malaria-infected mosquitoes arrive to the country of destination and either exit from baggage or cargo flight containers and have in fact a blood meal of one or more conveniently available human victims, tasty Britons, for instance, or tasty Americans. Taxi rank malaria is a unique entity to South Africa and to, in fact, the African continent, where taxis, minibuses, really move large amounts of people from malaria-endemic areas out, and mosquitoes often hitch a ride in these taxis, bringing, in fact, malaria right up to Johannesburg. The very, very ravenous and hungry anopheline female mosquito will bite any convenient person, and on taking a blood meal, even infect people who have not been to an endemic area. Runway malaria is really the term that is reserved for people that, while flying from one non-malaria destination to another, land up in an endemic area for a brief refueling stop. And during the refueling process, for whatever reason, if aircraft doors are open, mosquitoes enter the plane and they get bitten in this way. Notice that malaria has got nosocomial implications. It was implicated in an outbreak linked to gloves in 2001, multi-dose heparin vials contaminated in 2000, IV therapy apparatus, transfusions, syringes, and laboratory-acquired cases have all been described. And if you move to the next slide, you can see that, in fact, a nosocomial infection in South Africa was linked to a nurse who was a phlebotomist who pricked herself with a needle stick while she was drawing blood from a patient with malaria. And because the diagnosis was initially missed, malaria was not particularly, in fact, endemic in the clinic where she worked, they delayed the diagnosis and she died 3 weeks after the needle stick injury. Let's move on to the next slide where you can see some interesting South African phenomena. The beautiful man on the left-hand side of that slide is your talker. It's me, a little bit younger than normal, but here I was in Nigeria, and here it was interesting to see how readily antimicrobials were used. For instance, in street markets, it was quite easy for one to get, in fact, small aliquoted amounts of cloxicillin from a capsule that had been opened, usually put inside a little piece of newspaper and given to people for a wide variety of clinical conditions, ranging from menorrhagia to headaches to everything else but an infectious disease. So clearly the inadequate prescribing of antibiotics leads obviously to a huge problem of resistance. And the next couple of slides on gram-positive South African bacterial foes, gram-positive streptococci and opportunists on the slide after that, as well as in fact evidence that these organisms can actually spread, such as the glycopeptide-resistant enterococci that we find in our country, not only within different hospitals, but also between different institutions, inter-hospital spread, is really actually extremely important. We have described glycopeptide resistance, and these organisms are in fact a major problem. All of those slides showing you resistance patterns are for your own interest, and you can actually peruse them, and you can see how high our rates of resistance are compared to some of the institutions that I might be talking to this evening. You can see in the slide following that the effective spread of glycopeptide-resistant enterococci from our hospital, the Johannesburg Hospital, to five other private clinics in Johannesburg. And again, with molecular fingerprinting, if you study that slide more carefully in your own time, you'll see that we've been very ably successful in showing this inter-hospital spread of organisms that are multi-drug resistant. Of the gram-negative bacterial foes, I don't need to mention anything more, just to remind you that ESBL salmonellas, as discussed previously, are important, and all of that data is for your information. Now, please remember that the challenges of reducing antimicrobial resistance are often laid at the feet of the infection control practitioner. Infection control cannot reduce antimicrobial resistance. The restriction of optimizing antibiotic usage is the only strategy that can do this. Infection control, however, is crucial in the prevention of transmission. And for this, we need obviously good surveillance programs, and we need to feed this resistance data and the impact of infection control programs in preventing transmission to local, national, and global facilities. Next slide, please. We're coming to the end of the talk. Let me show you some of the good, the bad, and the ugly in our institution and how we cope with limited resources. So if you flip over, you'll see that some of our hospitals are really first-class institutions. Even our district hospitals may have wards that are beautifully and easily spaced. Notice the TB hospital with the patients that are actually taken out into the open air, so that effectively there's a dilutional effect when these patients are exposed to the open environment. Note that we have mobile clinics, and in general, some hospital facilities are in fact quite clean and quite good. However, these impressions are often marred by occasional articles, next slide please, which appear in the press, where in fact we get very bad publicity. Gauteng is a province that I work in, and the headline states, Gauteng's Hospitals of Neglect. Why my sister was let to rot to death, largely because of poor nursing and bed sores. And you see this very cynical cartoon to the right of that slide saying that considering that our staff limitations are what they are, we find it more cost-effective and time-effective to place the patients in the coffins. It's Ward 13, the doctors are out and not on duty, and you can see that this is in fact a very cynical remark of healthcare facilities in the South African context. Move to the next slide and see what spurs this on. In the facilities that are under-resourced, you may sometimes get up to 3 to 4 babies in a cot or in an incubator. You may find that in the height of the malarial season in some of our provinces, we have occupancies, as we've described before, in excess of 100%, in fact, usually 200-300%, where patients sleep on beds, they sleep on the floor, they sleep between beds. On the far-hand side, you can see the most horrific slide of a patient who is sleeping under a bed, and because he was confused, having cerebral malaria, the cot railings of that bed were pushed down to try and restrain him in some way. So this is the bad. What do we do about delivery of sterile supplies and waste disposal? Well, in rural clinics, it's unthinkable that you use autoclaving, the gold standard. But if you do literature searches and you very carefully look at how many cases have been reported of infections, particularly caused by Clostridium perfringens, a spore-forming organism, following adequate boarding procedures, you'll find that you will come up with a negative answer. So we propose that where there are no autoclaves and we don't have the resources available to you, that at least, in fact, boarding should be a minimum standard. This is affordable and doable in all healthcare facilities. It's cheap and it's extremely effective. Next slide, please. Notice that autoclaving facilities can range from top-of-the-art autoclaves in my hospital, top left-hand corner, to almost steam sterilizers look like pressure cookers, to pathetic little stoves that don't really work. And you can see that frequently, in fact, attempted sterilization is made with disinfectants, showing, in fact, a complete lack of insight when you're using, in fact, Savron for vaginal specular in terms of an attempt to remove potentially pathogenic organisms. Sometimes these disinfection practices are seen. Move on to the next slide and look at waste disposal. The mounds of unprotected waste become, in fact, wonderful sources for children to access. So they may actually cross into a waste area like this that has not been cordoned off or restricted, pick up syringes, play doctor, and inject themselves with potentially infectious blood. On the right-hand side, you see an incinerator in the Mpumalanga province. Of those of you who are very sharp-eyed, you might notice some foil paper inside that incinerator, and the door has fallen off and is on the floor. The incinerator guardian or caretaker was busy actually cooking or heating his sandwiches in that foil. And you can imagine that without an appropriate door to seal the heat, and if cooking procedures of food goes in incinerated waste, there's something seriously wrong with incineration ethics and policies in some institutions. Right below that, you see a placenta pit, which is in fact a hole in the ground in which tissues and even needles are discarded and then covered with a lid and sealed with a lock. And on the bottom right-hand slide, you can see that if you don't dispose of waste adequately, as again occurred in a Nigerian street market, you can find central venous catheters and urinary catheters still encrusted with patient secretions available for sale, and you normally purchase your own equipment before you enter a facility. The next slide is somewhat sinister, and I'm going to show it to you really for shock effect, because it is something that is disturbing and true, and this is the ugly of South Africa. This was an incident in our hospital when people broke into our contained waste disposal area looking at hazardous waste and specifically targeting all of the tubes that came from our laboratory that did viral loads and CD4 counts. In other words, the perpetrators of this theft knew that they were looking for HIV-infected blood. The bottom two slides, or pictures on the slide, actually show you that the caps are decanted from full blood count tubes and removed very carefully from the tubes themselves. All of the blood was emptied very carefully, and interestingly, in the same week when we found that this blood theft has occurred, and we had found the evidence of these stolen blood tubes and this carefully decanted blood into other containers, we had our first case of HIV bioterrorism, where apparently in the press, in fact, one person was held up for a car hijacking with an infected needle, with an infected syringe containing HIV-infected blood. We've also been able to trace through the police forces that a lot of this blood entered the traditional healer's market, and that therefore multi-medicine in South Africa is often actually based on infected blood, such as HIV-infected blood, with principle that possibly, in fact, like might get rid of like. With regards to surveillance, I need to just tell you about an exciting initiative, and I'm only saying one word, and that is that we are launching our first national nosocomial prevalence survey in 2005, and we're using, in fact, a very simple, manually completed questionnaire, which is then optically scanned, captured into a database, and exported into statistical packages. This study is done effectively in conjunction with the Directorate of Health in Belfast, and particularly the HISC unit. And our collaborators are people like Ed Smith. Move two slides down, and you'll see my collaborators in Belfast, and you'll also see the chickens that I have on my property that have been responsible for forging lots of friendships. These chickens are renowned worldwide, and they're certainly known to the Belfast group. So whenever I go there to plan our next collaborative prevalence survey for South Africa, the first question they ask is not how I am, but how my poultry is doing. Right, the next slide shows you circumcision-related sepsis, and again how simple it is for us to redefine the gold standard. Outbreaks of strep pyogenes infections have been well documented following ritual circumcisions. Now, rather than prevent a practice that is culturally important, what we do is we identify that the witch doctor performing these ritual procedures uses the same razor blade. So we reach an agreement with the traditional healer that we will provide sterile single-use blades and as many as he requires, provided that, in fact, he does not use the same blade twice. And the outcome in this particular outbreak was that with provision of new blades, there were no further cases. Imagine the blood-borne organisms that are transmitted by this route and that are still being transmitted by those traditional healers that have not bought into infection control. So my final slide is the way ahead for South Africa, land of contrast. Effectively, the first message that I want to give you is that no matter where you are in the world, we seem to complicate infection control all the time. And I truly believe that if we go back to basics, going back to basic principles, we'll protect ourselves against even formidable pathogens. In the South Africa, as is probably true in the world, there's the genetic requirement for that wonderful infection control nurse animal, somebody who has been gifted with common sense. Unfortunately, many of us cannot redefine the gold standard, and hence, within the context of limited resources, our expectations are much too high. We are introducing practicable surveillance for nosocomial infection. We're looking at the issues of waste disposal, making it safe. We always have to redefine the gold standard. We cannot take a CDC policy and simply implement it. We've got to revalidate it for what is feasible and doable in our own country. We put a lot of emphasis on education through the Department of Health. We obviously have to critically review to what extent we screen carriers. No good screening carriers of MRSA coming to a facility that has got 350% occupancy, because even if you know they're carrying the organism, you can't isolate them anyway. So again, we emphasize infection control at grassroots level and on the floor level to try and prevent cross-infection. Environmental cultures are very rarely done unless we really need to understand an outbreak. And most importantly, we need to understand the culture and behaviors of those people seeking alternative healers and try and persuade traditional healers to buy into the ethic of infection control. Finally, in our country, we have the National Antimicrobial Surveillance Forum that monitors, in fact, the burgeoning problem of antimicrobial resistance in our various facilities, and is also looking at the nosocomial spread of these organisms. So, ladies and gentlemen, the final slide is really to acknowledge Paul Weber Teleclasses for giving me this opportunity, a wide variety of other people that have been of huge inspiration to me while staying in this wonderful country, South Africa, and most importantly, to thank you all for your participation and listening. I hope that you have had some background and some information about the African situation, and if you have any questions, I would welcome them. Thank you.
Adriano, thank you very much for an interesting and, may I say, terrifying presentation. Clearly, there are a number of challenges for those of you who work in infection control in Africa, and I really applaud you and your effort. I know that you're doing a lot more than what is shown on these slides, and you personally have a deep commitment to this process, and I applaud that. Let me ask, though, what can people from other parts of the world do to support infection control in Africa?
Paul, this is a very, very good question. There are lots of people that are interested in seeing the reality for themselves. And in a sense, frequently people that come from very well-resourced countries battle with what we've shown them and what we've got. And they really struggle to make this paradigm shift of how you do infection control when you've got very limited resources and sometimes none. We believe that we always can do something, even if it's an inch more than nothing. And this is a basic premise that not many people can accept. But what we do appreciate is when, for instance, people like our collaborators in Belfast give us good physical support for tried and tested nosocomial prevalence surveys, that participate actively, that form links with our Department of Health. When healthcare workers express an interest in coming to work in our department, doing, for instance, elective and selective periods, where they can see the African reality, they can join us on roadshows, and they can learn and hopefully take back some of the messages home, and they realize, in fact, how privileged they are. I think any investment in education, any input, any commitment to doing collaborative work, any interest shown is more than enough for us. Just don't forget about us. That's all we ask.
Thank you very much. Dr. Duzet will return to us on December the 2nd with a teleclass titled Bugs, Blood, and Barrier Breaches, Lessons from the Challenges of Bloodborne Pathogens in Africa. That'll be a more detailed look at some of the things that we addressed today. My thanks again to Dr. Duzet.
Paul, thank you very much, and thank you for a wonderful series of classes.
And thank you, everyone, who is with us today. We'll talk again soon. Goodbye.